This is The Conversation. It's episode 201 with David Mazel. He is a Marin County-based photographer. Marin County is in the Bay Area of Northern California. Those of you not familiar, take the Golden Gate Bridge north, and once you cross it, you are in Marin County, FYI. And David is a stellar conversationalist, so I think you will enjoy what he has to say about so many different things. I am Michael Shaw, your host. The website for this podcast is theconversationpod.com, where, yes, you can go see images. And, you know, the great thing about having a photographer as your guest is you do get great images. So do go to theconversationpod.com to check out not only images of David's work, but also a couple of great shots of Marin County, including the view from his former home on Muir Beach. That's Muir as in John Muir, a California legend, somebody whose name you will see in various places in California from north to south. I'll tell you that David came from New York to the West Coast, and we talk about that. We do spend a good amount of time talking about where he lives, what it's like there, what it's been like, what it is like, around gentrification, more or less, before we get into the art and things related. So that's a little preview. And before we jump into that conversation, I wanted to take a moment and thank those of you who showed your appreciation for the podcast hitting 200 a couple weeks ago. Thank you very much to you guys, some of whom donated nicely, became Patreons on patreon.com as well. So thank you very much to you guys. And I wanted to point out briefly, and bear with me for a second as I go into public radio pitch mode, but it's like a Band-Aid. It will be ripped off quickly, relatively speaking. Everybody who shouted out with support and also contributed towards my little microphone fundraising campaign, they're all repeat supporters of the show. So there are a couple thousand or so of you out there who would be welcome new members to the financial support of the Conversation Club. So I wanted to say hello to you. Hello. And instead of you thinking, oh, that other guy or girl or person will donate, so I don't need to. No, you need to, because I'm doing a little fundraising to get a better mic. I'm going to sound so much better. I'm hoping to raise just a modest amount of money to get at least one mic for me, and then when I have in-person guests, another one for them as well. But for now, let's just focus on the one mic. Somewhere in the $200 range. I asked a couple times before for $10 from several people combined. We could hit that pretty quickly. So $10, you know, it's a great entry point. If you start at $25, though, as a one-time donation, you will be getting some bonus episodes and some love. Or via Patreon at $3 a month, you will get the same thing. And those are both linked on the support page, theconversationpod.com/support. So the Band-Aid is off. Doesn't it feel so much better? Clean, refreshing, healed. Yes, it does. It definitely does. All right. Thank you for listening to that. And thank you for being here. One little other announcement on the back end, maybe two. I hope you're well. I hope you enjoy this conversation, and I will talk to you more on the back end. All right, David. Well, hello, and hello from Southern California to Northern California. As the old sort of one of the old cliches goes, it seems to be kind of probably less relevant every day, being that people are probably fleeing the Bay Area, you know, on a regular basis. But there was this long-running cliche that Northern Californians hated Southern Californians, or at least Southern California. So where do you fall in that camp?
You know, I'll answer it in a roundabout way. I'm a transplant from the East Coast, so to me, the divide is less northern versus southern rather than, you know, West Coast versus East. But I did get to live in Los Angeles when I was doing a residency at the GRI, and I loved living there. Of course, I was living rent-free in a lovely, you know, two-bedroom apartment in Brentwood. So it was there was that to be said for it. You know, I was getting to hang out at the Getty all the time.
Yeah.
But the experience of living there, even just for a few months, really changed my view of, you know, why LA can be so appealing, you know? And I think that I've kept that, you know, it's been, I guess, a decade since I did that residency, but yeah. I don't, you know, my daughter lives in LA, and, I love every chance I get to be there. So, yeah.
So your daughter is an adult, young adult?
My daughter's a young adult. She just completed her master's in art history at the Courtauld, and she's now working, doing a 9-month curatorial internship at the Norton Simon in Pasadena. So she just last month moved to Silver Lake and started work at the Norton Simon a few weeks ago.
Wow. And what was the institution that she got her master's from? What was that called?
Oh, she went to the Courtauld Institute in London. It's a great, apparently very highly respected art history program there. And the master's degrees there are 1 year versus, you know, in the States, two.
Right.
So it, you know, it went by very quickly, but I think it was, you know, fantastic program for her.
You seem way too young to be having a young adult child out in the world. What's going on?
I'm 56.
That's too young. How does an artist have a kid that young? How does an artist have a kid that young?
You know, it's really interesting. My wife and I met when we were 18 and 20, so
okay.
We spent a while trying not to have a child. And then once we were married and once we moved out of our live-work studio, you know, maybe 750 square foot studio in New York, we migrated to the West Coast and landed, strangely enough, in Muir Beach, north of San Francisco. But at that point, we kind of looked at each other and we're like, well, you know, maybe we ought to see how this thing goes. And, you know, we didn't take long. I was 33 when my daughter was born.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's not, I mean, I think, considering when that was, obviously about 20 odd years ago, that was probably more common. But I mean, now for artists that have kids, it seems to be at 35 seems to be kind of the bottom end, the young end of that, right?
Yeah. I mean, it was, you know, it's certainly a juggling act when you have a family. And, you know, but I also have, my wife and I had one child, and she came with us everywhere, and you know, to every museum
we
ever went to, you know, and it's no, you know, no wonder that she ended up going into art history, frankly.
Yeah.
But you know, so and honestly, I think being a parent when you're younger, in some ways is a lot easier. And you know, my daughter's grown and out of the house, and, you know, I'm around to enjoy her as a young adult and also, you know, not be parenting.
Yeah.
You know, friends of mine who are the same age I am and might have, you know, much, much, much younger children who are still at home.
Yeah.
That's a completely different kind of set of conditions. Yeah. So.
Yep, that I think you did it the right way. It's just that coming from my own perspective, and I imagine some who are listening, you know, that window of early 30s being ready to have kids is it's a really short window. And as an artist, it's a very unrealistic window often, it seems.
Yeah, it's interesting to think back on that time period. I think because my wife and I had been together for so long, even though we hadn't been married that long, we'd been a couple, since we were, really young adults. And we were in this kind of spirit of adventure and experimentation, frankly, by moving to the West Coast, by moving to the Bay Area, by leaving New York, by leaving behind, a lot of social conditions in New York and family and history. It was in that spirit. And actually, because we were in Muir Beach, which, we were in this little house that we happened to stumble into renting that faced out to the Pacific Ocean. And, you look out at infinity. And actually, I think it really changed us on a fundamental level. Like, you just feel the possibilities in life in a different way. Not to say there weren't some challenges by living there. It was isolating, but it really kind of made us feel like anything's possible.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Where exactly is it Muir Beach?
It's Muir, like John
Oh,
Muir,
Muir, John Muir, Muir
Muir.
Beach. Right,
Yeah,
right.
yeah,
And where is
yeah.
that?
So it's about maybe 15 miles or less from the Golden Gate Bridge, maybe 12 miles. You go out Coastal Route 1,
Right.
and there's really no commercial anything there other than a sort of English pub, like bed and breakfast kind of place. It's all residential. There's not many homes there, maybe a couple hundred homes max. And the area that we were living in was kind of right above the portion of the beach that had historically been the nude beach. So it
Right.
had this kind of like, vestigial counterculture,
Right.
aura about it. And then actually another thing that's out there is the Zen Center. Green Gulch that has a farm, and it's basically it's a Buddhist retreat and education center, and to go from Manhattan
Yeah. Yeah.
to there, it was glorious and sometimes like crazy making,
Yeah.
because it was a very different world. I'm talking 1990. 93, 1993. So
It makes sense.
pre-internet,
But it makes sense that you would leave New York and you would come to Northern California and you would just go full on into some of the cliches of the West Coast, as opposed to like living in a really, gritty part of San Francisco, as for example, as a difference.
I think, to be honest, my wife in particular, but really both of us, were kind of burned out on urban living. When you
Yeah.
think about what the late 80s and early 90s were in New York and what the economy was like. And, to be young and poor in New York has a kind of allure, but it was getting pretty old. And
Yeah.
we were, we contemplated a bunch of different possible places to go next, but I really, we even thought about, just moving within the city, moving up the Hudson, moving out to the far east end of Long Island, and I just wanted to get away out of the gravitational orbit of the city. I really wanted to try something else. So,
Yeah. And you and your wives' respective families are from the New England or New York even area?
My wife grew up in Ithaca, and so most of her family at that point was still there. I grew up in the suburbs of New York. My folks eventually, well, my father eventually ended up moving into Manhattan from the suburbs, but years before that, both of my siblings had left for. Well, one sister was in Los Angeles, another sister was in various places around the globe, including Israel and Japan and London. And so, you know, the model was there.
Yeah.
For, yeah. You know, for, you know, trying new things.
Right.
And, you know, I don't really know if at the time I thought it would be a forever decision, but I don't think I was thinking in those ways. It was an experiment,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So. Yeah. And so to sort of come back to being in the Bay Area, without getting more into the Northern, Southern, East Coast, West Coast, but so you're, just for listeners, you're based in Sausalito, which is your beach is in Marin County, I presume, and obviously so is Sausalito.
Yeah.
So you're still in
right.
the same county, no, just north of San Francisco.
Right.
And what, I mean, was there ever a consideration of living, and did you in fact live in the city of San Francisco itself at any point?
No. So I thought when we decided to move to the Bay Area that naturally we'd be living in the city.
Yeah.
That was really kind of my assumption.
Right.
And as it got closer for us to make that move, I had an assistant in New York who'd moved back to the Bay Area where he was from. And he hosted us on a visit to the Bay Area. And I think my wife in particular really wanted to try something that wasn't urban, for a change, you know, for
yeah.
a respite.
Yeah.
And so, because of that, we were looking around just north of the city for something to rent. And that's how we just stumbled into this home in Muir Beach, that was, you know, you couldn't invent it out of, you know, you couldn't imagine such a place. It was,
uh-huh.
you know, I mean, it was tiny, 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 exquisite little beach house with, you know, 20-foot high windows facing out to the ocean, you know,
wow.
tiny, but just a jewel box filled with light. And I think it cost the exact same amount that we had been paying for our, you know, horrendous
right.
studio in Manhattan. So
yeah.
it was, you know, there was a kind of like the real estate gods were taking mercy on us.
Right. Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, so that's how we got here. And then, it just worked out to, you know, at a certain point when I started looking around for a studio, I was looking around, south of Market in the city and in China Basin and just kind of assuming that I would be, you know, in the city. And my wife and her, Lynn, in her infinite wisdom said, you know, if this is what you want to do, you should do it. But, you know, you're going to spend a lot of time in your car.
Yeah.
and so I started looking around closer to where we were living and came upon this place. And I'm actually still in the same compound. So I've been in the same compound with my studio since right before my daughter was born. So actually it's been 23 years now
yeah.
that I've been here. And it was built as an elementary school. And then it had been converted into spaces for artists, or arts related businesses. So graphic designers and,
mm-hmm.
you know, et cetera, et cetera. Now it has over time reverted. Actually there's two private elementary schools that have the lion's share of the real estate here, but there are still some artists and arts related businesses. And so I'm still here.
Yeah.
So it's worked out beautifully.
Yeah. You know, and as you're talking about that, the thing that it comes to mind is the location for an artist. You're going from being right in the thick of it in Manhattan to being in, you know, a much smaller art community and not even sort of, and sort of on the outside of it, at least geographically. And so I guess that, you know, that obviously raises the question based on your experience, and maybe this is a bit of a non-issue I'm kind of predicting because of where your career was kind of arcing, but having that easy proximity, being in New York to, you know, visits and that kind of thing versus being in the Bay Area and having presumably for people to see your work, you know, that they need to schlep across the Golden Gate Bridge, which maybe isn't such a bad thing, but, you know, how did you find that as far as, the need to be accessible.
Yeah. You don't have the chance encounters with people that you have in a more urban setting, that's for sure.
Yeah.
I don't think people object to coming over the bridge. I'm really close to the city. Mm-hmm. But it is a bit out of the fray. You know, it became clear that I work much better in these kind of circumstances where I have a certain amount of quiet and privacy and light and, you know, parking.
Yeah.
and things like that. So what it might lack in the form of community, I have found through being involved with the Headland Center for the Arts, which is in Marin. It's these repurposed military buildings in the Marin Headlands that were transformed by artists 35 years ago into studio spaces, and it's a great residency program there and other public programmings. And so I did a residency there in 2007.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm on the board, and I've been on the board for 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that involvement there, and also having gotten my MFA at CCA, those are the things that have kind of given me the community, you know, that I love to have. So, and that, you know, I really, it's essential, you know. So it is a balancing act, but, you know, in the Bay Area too, you know, it is unlike New York. Things are more spread out. So there are artists in Oakland, you know, there are artists in Berkeley, artists in San Francisco, and now there are artists that are moving, you know, to Benicia and further, further flung parts of the Bay because that's what's affordable. So
where's Benicia, by the way?
I don't even know why I chose that place.
But it's a distant suburb.
Or to Petaluma, which is, in Sonoma County, or right on the border of Sonoma County.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's other elements at play here now, just in terms of affordability, right?
Yeah. You know, but before we get more into the Bay Area, I want to look at this luck or coincidence or whatever word is the right word. I'm stumbling to find the right word. Just related to the fact that you came upon such an ideal situation as far as being on the coast and being a little, you know, in a little bit of a suburban or rural or you know, less than urban area, or less than heavily urban area. And just wondering the thought that comes to mind, you know, here you are in Manhattan, you know, in the early 90s. Just think of how many other artists were in a similar situation who didn't leave, who are still there, you know, and how, to what extent they've had miserable artist lives because of that. I mean, how many artists do you think are still in the New York area, you know, not having recognized that they could have lived this other alternate life?
Yeah, that's a really provocative question. I think there's some part of me that always likes to have a plan B, whether or not I get to act it out.
Right.
And I had a fantasy, and that's really the best possible way to describe it, about living in the Bay Area, probably from the time I was 10, before I'd ever been to California, you know, before I'd ever been even to the West Coast at all. There was an idea that the Bay Area represented. I don't know why, but the seeds got planted for me, you know, very young. And it was as a kind of fantasy. It was like as this place that you go to kind of recreate yourself. And I'm glad I did it when I did. I don't think it would have necessarily gotten any easier, you know, as I got older. So, yeah.
I, too, had my own fantasy for a few years anyway, because I myself was living in New York, and I had visited San Francisco, the city itself, a few times. My brother was living there for a few years, And I kind of fantasized about living there in the city for a bit. And I just, you know, certainly this is well before the whole tech revolution. But were you ever charmed in that similar way by certain neighborhoods in the city and kind of want to live there? Or was it enough just to be in the city for a day kind of thing?
Oh, there's definitely neighborhoods in the city that I thought were interesting. I think it might have been the very first time I came to San Francisco on my own. I ended up being here during the Loma Prieta quake in '89.
Right.
And I was so fortunate that I had met up with a friend who was working at a gallery in Union Square. So I met up with him there and he said, "Oh, I'm going to ride my bike back to my house in the Mission. You know, why don't you take BART and then, you know, we'll hang out at my place." And so mm-hmm. I ended up being with him and his wife during the quake, thankfully, rather than being on BART or wandering around Union Square by myself.
Right.
So I had a lot of affection for the Mission
yeah.
after that. I don't know that I wanted to live there per se, but yeah, I mean, there would always be neighborhoods that I would sort of stumble into, like Coal Valley, is a really beautiful little spot.
Mm-hmm.
And, Diamond Heights is kind of interesting just because you get up so high. And so, yeah, there are all these little pockets of the city. And also, you know, like never say never, like maybe someday we'll end up living in San Francisco versus next door to it, you know? So,
well, that actually raises kind of the through line question of this, you know, the early part of this, the early parts of these podcasts, which is about rent and affordability and so on. So you got in to the market, as it were. I assume you and your wife own your house. Is that right?
Yes.
So in Sausalito, which obviously is close enough or is enough in the thick of things. Certainly Marin is not cheap by any stretch of the imagination, I would imagine. But I guess in your case, in theory, you could do a one-off exchange, you know, with whatever your house value is with something in the city. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, we actually live one town north of Sausalito in Mill Valley.
Oh, you're in Mill Valley, right.
So we bought this house in 1997. It's an older house. It was built post 1906 earthquake. That our neighborhood was kind of where the workers were housed, the workers that were rebuilding the city lived. So they're very small lots. Our little sunroom touches our next door neighbor's deck, you know, so we're close to each other.
Right.
And it's more like a town or a village than a suburb. Or that's sort of the feel of it.
Mm-hmm.
And because we can walk, we're in the level part of town. We can walk to downtown to the restaurants and movie theater and the library and the schools and et cetera, et cetera. It has become absurdly expensive, just absurdly, obscenely, surreally, you know, costly.
Mm-hmm.
But we got in there before the Bay Area's first tech boom and before this part of the Bay Area was, you know, as sort of discovered as it's been. And every time you think, oh my gosh, it couldn't possibly go any higher, you know, I mean, the ripple effect of the tech industry now is definitely being felt in the Marin housing market. I mean, in all the Bay Area. But, you know, our house is very livable. It's not big. It's easy to take care of, and we can walk everywhere. So, you know, there's a lot. We can, again, it's great to sort of fantasize, well, what might come next, you know?
Yeah.
But there's a way in which my wife and I, you know, we do have these conversations. Well, where would we go next? And, you know, perhaps the answer would be, well, we'd rent our place out, right, for a while, and then, you know, move to wherever, like move to London for a year, move to Rome, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So it does give you a kind of freedom because though we've never rented it before, to think that, you know, it could give you that income to do something else for a while. But I don't think we're ready to throw in the towel on this area.
Do you know if Airbnb usage has taken place in Mill Valley or around there?
Oh, sure. Yeah. We have friends who've done Airbnb, you know, even to just a room in their house. And yes.
And they can probably charge a pretty penny, I would imagine.
I guess. I mean, I'm not sure. But yeah, it's certainly easy.
Yeah.
Easy income, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I it's just, you know, the way that is those figures have been, you know, I mean, because there's a pretty big market for it in San Francisco, you know, it's maybe not too terrible, but it's definitely gone up a lot since Airbnb, you know, got going. And I imagine that it could be even more extreme in Marin because there's probably less supply.
That's true. There's less housing stock, as
right.
they say.
Yeah.
I mean, it's funny. I when we bought our house, I don't think it was the first time, you know, homeowners, we were pretty naive. I don't think we really understood all of the good points about the neighborhood, meaning its walkability, it's, you know, it's livability, but nor did we understand exactly what we were getting into with how, with the, the severity of how decrepit our house actually was. So it's been nursed back to health over the years. It needed, you know, everything done to it, every possible thing done to it. So slowly over time, we got to chip away at that.
I see.
So,
right.
The labor of love for sure. And now what we see happen in the neighborhood conversely is, you know, a house gets sold and it gets knocked down and something new goes in its place, or it gets, you know, rehabbed extensively. So you wouldn't even recognize it, its former incarnation.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, it's a different,
So one more thing about Marin / Mill Valley, just since it is on my mind, and it would be a shame if I didn't even at least mention it. How would you describe, for an outsider, the cliches or the sort of cliched perceptions around Marin? And, you know, maybe it's some homogeneity, it's, you know... it's yoga, meditation, you know, new agey, what have you, any of those kinds of cliches.
Right.
What do you actually experience on the ground?
I think those cliches, though, are from a former era, you know, when it was a little bit kind of post-hippie, right?
Right.
Now, if you're doing yoga, it's probably hot yoga, and you probably drove over there from your Pilates class in your enormous German SUV, and you barreled through a few stop signs along the way, you know, taking out a few bikers or pedestrians.
Right,
so
right.
The vibe is really, really changed.
Wow.
And it's an aggressive. It's interesting because there is this kind of veneer of, oh, it should be laid back, yeah. But there's also this intensity, I think, that is not even just below the surface. It's right there on the surface. It's bright and shiny and sharp, and it's that is something that I feel change month by month.
So some of your neighbors, in other words, are like entertainment industry types, it sounds like.
Tech industry, I assume.
Yeah. No, I mean, not literally, just in terms of their sensibilities, their harshness, their aggression.
Right. Yeah, it seems that way. It seems that way. And I hate to deal in you know,
sure.
Stereotypes.
Right.
But that is a current that is present, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you can't not, as a longtime resident, you can't not look around at, you know, the newcomers or even the not so newcomers, but a lot newer than you, and throw up your hands and say, you know, what is it with these newcomers, right?
yeah. No, it's interesting. It is changing, and you know, it's not even to say that some of these folks haven't lived there. You know, weren't raised in the same town themselves, right? But I think the wealth, gives rise to a certain sense of privilege. Whether you were born here or whether you moved here from Southern California, or anywhere, right? Or New York, or anywhere, right? Or Tokyo, or anywhere. It doesn't matter. There is a kind of intensity, and I think that's prevalent really widely in the Bay Area.
That's exactly what I was thinking. You probably saw San Francisco 2.0. I mean, that's this exact story that they tell. Okay. All right. Well, we've gotten a good half hour out of location, and we barely talked about gentrification. But all right. So you're a photographer. You're an artist. You do photography. Do you to not go too abruptly from one place to another? Do you, as somebody in Marin, if it comes up, do you get asked? You know, maybe not that often, but if it does come up, do you say you're an artist? Do you say you're a photographer? Does it matter?
I don't know that I get asked.
Nobody cares.
probably if the question weren't being asked, then they would probably assume that I was, a stockbroker.
Yeah.
Right. Isn't that what everybody is around here?
Right.
No, I say I'm a photographer and an artist.
Right. And when you went to CCA, which for people who don't know, it's California College of the Arts, is that what it is?
Yeah.
And it used to be the California College of Arts and Crafts back in the day.
Right. In fact, I guess when I was there, it was CCAC.
Okay.
And maybe at some point in the midst of it, they dropped that second C, which was kind of a point of contention.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
But I simply was wondering if your grad school was in any way like a transition in terms of your identity, or if you would generally consider that you've pretty much your whole artistic life been a quote unquote photographer as opposed to an artist who does photographs or whatever, you know what I mean? I don't want to get too semantic about it, but there is certainly, a bit of a pseudo ghettoization of the photographer in a certain way in the art world.
Yeah, sure. I was doing photography before I came to CCA, and I started studying photography as an undergrad at a point where I really thought, and I had thought for a very long time, that I would become an architect. So for me, whatever station photography occupies in the art world to me is kind of not that interesting a question. It is what it is, and you make of it what you make of it. And I think actually photography in the time I've been doing it has matured wildly, in the art world and in people's kind of interest in it and perception of it and, engagement with it at a much more sophisticated level.
Yeah.
But for me, like the issue wasn't so much, oh, should I be a painter, or a sculptor or a filmmaker? It was really, am I going to be an architect the way I always kind of had thought I was from a really young age and was developing those interests in pretty, intentional ways? Or am I going to slip out of that identity and that path into being a photographer? So that to me was always like the tension and the I don't know what this kind of obsessive circling back going back and forth between the two for the better part of a decade. So
you were going back and forth between photography and architecture?
So I had gone to undergrad with the intention of majoring in architecture. I had done a kind of pre-professional architecture program one summer at Cornell when I was in high school. I spent hours as a kid in the when I was in high school and probably even middle school in the library, like looking, you know, studying the New York Five and worked for an architecture firm, took a year off of college, worked for an architecture firm for a while in New York. And when I went back to school, I decided to not major in architecture, but actually to the way you get to study visual arts, where I did my undergrad, is you actually are an art history major, and then you do a program in visual arts. And I did that specifically because I was interested in working with the photographer Emmett Gowan, who was teaching there. And so I got to work really closely with him. But then as time went on, after graduating, I worked for an architectural photographer in New York, a wonderful photographer named Paul Warshall. And we got to travel around and photograph some just insanely amazing projects by, it could be by H.H., it could be by H.H. Richardson, it could have been by Stephen Hall, it could, you know, it could have been by Frank Gehry, I mean, Todd Williams and Billy Tien. And then I was like, okay, I gotta go back to school for architecture again. So I started a master's program, and I did 1 year of that master's program in architecture. And then at the end of it, I moved back to New York and kind of put my stake in the ground and said, I'm a photographer. So I realized that as much as I love what architecture is about, I didn't feel like I had the patience to, I wanted to make things, you know.
Yeah.
I didn't want to make drawings of place, you know, I didn't want to make foam core models.
Yeah.
I wanted to make something that was mine. And the only way, for me, the only way to do that as an architect would be actually to make buildings, you know, real, to realize them. And I knew I didn't have the patience for that. I respect people who've, you know, among my crowd there who have stuck with it and have, you know, fascinating architectural practices. I think it's amazing. But I knew I couldn't put off that sense of completion and satisfaction to what it meant to make something yourself. So for me, you know, like the medium of photography is a way that I get to work with a lot of the issues that interested me in architecture. But I get to realize things a lot more quickly and with more autonomy and, you know, that kind of thing.
I think there's not a small number of artists who were interested in architecture at some point in their earlier / educational lives and recognize that exact same thing, you know, which is, you don't, you get to help or you get to plan, but you don't get to actually make, except on very rare occasions and with a lot of time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly. So, yeah.
So to talk about your photography, I'll just note for listeners who might not be familiar with your work that you actually, from what I've seen of your various bodies of work, do not do a lot of architectural photography. Not surprisingly, but just in case people imagine that you've been doing a lot of architectural photography, that's not the case. So you, one of the things that you have been doing for, it appears, quite a while, is taking shots from planes, from aerial perspectives. So when did that start? How long ago did that start? And what was the genesis and so on?
Yeah. So I mentioned the photographer Emmett Gowan and working with him as an undergrad. He, at the time, was doing a long-term project at the volcano Mount St. Helens. And he had taken a student with him on one or two of those excursions over a couple of years. And he was getting ready to go again. And I kind of volunteered myself for the task. So, and he's really an amazingly generous teacher. So I got to travel with him to St. Helens. And most of the work we did there was on the ground and with view cameras. So very slow and static. You know, a view camera, you're going under a dark cloth and focusing on the ground glass and using mm-hmm. sheet film and things like that. So slow.
Yeah.
And laborious and very sort of intentional in terms of composition. But Emmett had also been working from the air, and so we did make some trips up in a little Cessna around the volcano, and he lent me a medium format camera that was more suited to working from the air. And I was immediately hooked. It's really challenging way to work technically. It's, you know, you're also in constant motion, so it's very unlike working with a view camera on the ground. Mm-hmm. But there's this quality of mapping which actually to me connects in some very essential way to how architects see space when they're rendering things, you know, like for example, just, you know, a plan of a building, a floor plan, is you're seeing this thing from above, right? So anyway, it was something that felt challenging, but also familiar. And it's also to some degree kind of a threatening way of working. And I kind of liked that spark of fear. Mm-hmm. But it also enables you to see things that in a completely different way that you would otherwise not be able to see. So that's kind of...
Where does the threatening part come in?
Oh, you know, I'm so used to it now, but, you know, when I'm working with a pilot, I'm having him bank the plane really severely and go into these very tight mm-hmm. spins.
Right.
And so you're not, it's not the usual, like, let's go on a little tourist flight kind of, you know, encounter. Your stomach's in your throat.
I see.
And, you know, some folks can't handle that kind of activity. I find it really intoxicating and kind of an out-of-body experience a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to play up the danger part of it because, you know, it's dangerous crossing the street. So,
right.
Right. But helicopters, I think, are for me, still challenging versus working out of a Cessna. A Cessna to me feels like you're almost in like a little Volkswagen bug that has wings, you know.
Right.
Helicopters feel, in contrast, you know, you take the door off or you have the door open, you're really exposed, you're leaning out. There's a kind of step where you can literally, you know, plant yourself half in and half out of the body of the helicopter. And that does feel threatening. It should feel threatening. So,
yeah.
But that, you know, those elements of like, it's just very exhilarating. And the fact that you can't, even in a helicopter where you can sort of hover, you know, most of my work's not from a helicopter, but from a little Cessna, you know, you cannot make the same frame twice. So as you're looking through the viewfinder, it's this kind of constantly shifting, changing, series of compositions, you know? And so you really have this kind of mind body engagement with your subject. Very different, I would think, than say, you know, using a drone or, you know, downloading something high res from Google
yeah,
Earth or
sure.
something. You know, you're physically occupying that space and it exerts forces on you, on your body. So, I really, really enjoy it. You know,
so in other words, if I could jump in, do you,
yeah.
even if the viewer is not, let's just assume for the sake of argument, or you know, or maybe I'm just putting this out there as a perception and you can correct me if you think it's, not on point, that the viewer is not necessarily picking up any of that, but because the process or because just the experience, maybe is just a better word, of photographing from the air, whether it's a helicopter or a Cessna, that part of taking the actual photo is important to you, and the way you're having that experience is important regardless of how it is perceived in the final image.
Yeah, I think there is a part of it that's I like the way chance kind of comes into it. You know, it's a balance between control and lack of control that interests me. You know, you go in and it, like I said, you know, it's a technical endeavor. You have to know what you're doing. You have to have the right gear. You have to have researched the sites you want to look at and whatever, all that stuff. And then it's expensive. And fuel is, you know, however much fuel you have before you have to land and refuel or whatever. So, and however many frames you have on a roll until you're done with that 12 frames on a roll with this, I'm actually still shooting film. Timing that, you know, how a pilot comes in and out of a bank. So how many frames you have and what the, like anticipating what the composition will be, as it's changing. So you are ready. So all of those kinds of things. I don't know that the viewer would necessarily get any of that from the images because
that's my They're point. So what we're talking about is your experience sort of, this is your, for lack of a better analogy, your abstract expressionist moment, you know, is you feeling the gravitational forces, the mechanical forces of your plane or helicopter, you know, the danger and so on. So that's your, it's, I guess, you know, as I'm saying that, I'm realizing that's, it's an interesting kind of contradiction, you know, because you're doing this sort of very, aggro kind of thing, for lack of a better word, and the results are actually very cool by comparison, as opposed to that ABX analogy.
Yeah, Michael, I think that's right. I do.
Yeah.
I totally agree with that.
Okay,
yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
Well, there's so much.
I mean, you were. Oh, go ahead. Yeah.
I'm sorry. I was just hold that thought for a second. I just want to lay out the next phase of this exchange, which is there's so much that we could get into about the technical aspects of it. I definitely want to ask about what it, you know, what goes into the helicopter and plane, you know, maneuvering and so on. But before I do, what was that thought that you wanted to get out?
Oh, I was just going to kind of continue the vein of, you know, I mean, so St. Helens was the first encounter I had with working from the air. I was there in a way as a guest of my teacher.
Sure.
But when I came back to suburban New Jersey where I was in school and I started thinking about the, how I wanted to kind of continue working, you know, so it goes on from there. Basically, it sort of continues
right.
to unfold.
Like,
okay, then what? Then what? Then what? You've been given a glimpse of something that's really interesting and provocative. How, you know, what do you do with it? And how do you develop it on your own? And so, you know, it kind of went on from there. So
yeah, and to go and before I ask you about the plane photographing, to go from that very personal perspective of it, I this was one of the things I knew I was going to ask you about before we talked, and that is, and I think I want to ask this like for you retrospectively as opposed to, you know, when you were moving on from St. Helens to the next thing. Retrospectively, how aware were you of other photographers, you know, taking to the air? I mean, obviously there's probably a tradition of it, you know, on a more technical level, but obviously also there are a lot of fine art photographers who have been shooting from the air. And do you feel like there was, to what extent has there been a cognizance of your fellow air photographers, and do you know each other, and so on and so forth?
Right. You know, at the time when I was getting involved with it as an undergrad, like I said, you know, I was actually in the art history department, and there was a great photo historian there, Peter Bunnell. So we got to see an amazing range of prints by many different kinds of photographers. And so I wasn't so interested in what other aerial photographers were doing per se, but I was interested in couple of different artists for varying reasons. Like the photographer Frederick Sommer, who was Emmett's mentor in a way, he had been making these horizonless views in the American desert. And what interested me in those pictures were their lack of scale and their incredible sense of detail.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, not an aerial photographer per se at all, but using some ways of making pictures that interested me. Or then someone like Gordon Matta Clark, who was like, you know, cutting houses apart and thinking about, or buildings apart and thinking about how something comes into being while it's being taken apart. That really kind of influenced the subject matter that I was looking at.
Yeah.
You know, or at the time, like Robert Smithson, you know, he was not an aerial photographer, but he was really shrewd about how to deploy aerial views of things like the Spiral Jetty. So, you know, his work was something else completely, but interested me quite a bit. You know, working with scale in the American West. So
it's really interesting the way you're aligning yourself. I think that's not a hugely uncommon thing, but there's this tendency for some artists who are working in a style or format, if that's the right word, where a bunch of people are doing it or several people are doing it, and you know, some of those artists will talk about the sort of bigger picture, the sort of more disparate and kind of cooler influences, rather than saying, you know, yeah, I'm, you know, we all are, we're a part of a little movement, you know, we're the aerial photography movement group. You know,
right.
it's like, oh no, I don't want to be part of that ghetto. You know, I want to be part of the lineage of Gordon Matta Clark and Robert Smithson, and, you know, going back to the original sort of pioneers who didn't even have a chance to take photographs from the air, but sort of mimicked that experience.
Yeah. Right, right. I mean, there are some photographers who've made work from the air that I really admire, for sure. Sophie Ristel-Huber is one. She's a French photographer, just amazing, and has photographed war zones, areas of conflict, you know, in this way that's really, really tough and really intense.
Mm.
But, you know, I'll take it even one step further than what you were saying, Michael, and offer that I don't really think of myself as an aerial photographer. I know that's ridiculous, but because so much of my work has been made from the air, not all of it, but it's just a tool. You know, and yes, I kind of went on at length for what it feels like to make that work and what, you know, what the tensions involved with it are. But, you know, I don't know. It's interesting. You know, like if we looked at Atjeh's work, we wouldn't say, oh, you're a tripod photographer or something. You know, like, you know, it's just the device.
Sure.
By which you get to see and occupy these spaces and make pictures of sites that would otherwise be invisible. And that's the thing that kind of gets me excited even more, you know, than like the craziness of working from the air, is like the wildness of seeing these places that are otherwise kind of not really visible.
Sure.
So,
yeah, no, I, just to clarify, I wouldn't say David Maisel, aerial photographer. I don't call you an aerial photographer either. I mean, to be more specific, some of your work has been aerial shots of environmental degradation. You know, you maybe have a different wording to describe it. And other photographers have also done aerial photographs of aerial degradation. So I'm just saying, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. there has, you know, and that's the case with all art, of course. There's always another similar artist's work. But that's kind of what I had in mind when I was asking that sort of in the first place. And, you know, and you don't have to get into it more because I think you made your points. But if you want to, I don't want to keep you from it.
There's, I, you know, when I, I'm, okay, so I'm standing here at my bookcase, and I'm looking at the books in my bookcase to see if there's any books with aerial photography in them.
Right.
And there's a couple. There's a couple books by Emmett Gowan. A couple, I think Mike Light is represented in here. But, you know, it stops. I mean, I have hundreds of books here. You know, it stops pretty fast. And so if I have to think about the work that, you know, engages me, and makes me think, you know, I mean, here's a bunch of books I bought this year or was given, this year, but that, like, you know, this great film project, JG by Tacita Dean, is this exquisite little book, this great book by Adam Brunberg and Ali Chinaran, the Holy Bible, exceptional about conflict, basically. You know, so I could kind of keep going down the line, you know, this incredible book by Richard Moss, Incoming, his recent project. And like, so not aerial photography.
Yeah. Gotcha. Okay. So what about taking photographs from a Cessna and from a, I was most interested actually in your description of the working from a helicopter, because you described basically, it sounds like one half of your body is kind of hanging on to the main bed of the, or the main carrier of the copter itself, and then like you've got a leg and an arm out on like that, the landing post. Is it that
be.
Kind of thing?
You can be. I mean, you can put a leg outside and kind of position, you know, you don't have to. But it, even with the door off or open, you know, you feel vulnerable in a way that I feel vulnerable in a way that I wouldn't from a Cessna. Even with a Cessna, it will pop the window out, so it can kind of stay open in the airstream. So yeah, you're just more exposed.
But what about, are there tricks in which there's a hatch in the bottom of a helicopter that you've used as well, or?
No, and you know, that's an interesting point worth making. You know, you could mount a camera in the belly of the aircraft and not be exposed at all, but that doesn't really interest me. Because I want the camera to be in my hands, you know, and I want there to be this kind of physical, I'm usually like contorting around in the seat to get the specific frame that I want, as the, especially with the Cessnas, as they're kind of banking. So when they come into, when the pilot goes into a bank or comes out of a bank, you get these kind of oblique views, these kind of oblique renderings of space, especially as you're looking down, that don't correspond to like a straight on orthogonal view looking down, like a map maker would use, like a topographic, you know, USGS kind of thing.
Right.
And so the translation of space, it gets more complicated, literally more complicated spatially. And again, it gets at that same that idea I mentioned earlier. You can't make the same frame twice. You could circle around the same space again and again, but you're never going to be making exactly the same thing. And I like that.
Are you using primarily, I'm going to guess, a medium or large format digital camera?
I'm actually shooting with a medium format film camera.
Oh, that's right. You did say
use
film.
I mean, you know, never say never, but I really like how this.
Well, how
camera
practically? Yeah. How big is it as far as weight and awkwardness?
It's a Hasselblad camera. So if you think back to maybe, you know, pictures you might have seen of like astronauts on the moon, it's not huge. You can handhold it. I also have a gyroscope, that gets, mounted to the camera. So that's what makes it more awkward. But what that does is it absorbs a lot of the vibration, and so allows you to get basically more frames that are sharp or sharp enough. You know, I'm making prints that are up to 4 feet by 4 feet.
Mm-hmm.
Actually now I'm starting to go up to something that's 10 feet by 10 feet.
Wow.
And so I want there to be enough detail, mm-hmm. and sharpness, you know, in those frames. So the gyroscope just is immensely helpful.
Sure. Sure.
In that way.
Yeah. Yeah. And another practical consideration is obviously the budget and so on, which is, I'm sure, a lot of fun, but how do I want to ask this? To what extent are you dependent on a grant? You know, how often do you have to go out of pocket? You know, how many trips, let's say you're doing one of your bodies, like one of your recent bodies, mm-hmm. how many sessions are you typically going to take? Is it going to be several sessions in one day? Is it going to be one session a day over several days, et cetera?
Yeah, it varies. You know, it varies depending on what, all kinds of different conditions. Mm-hmm. The most current project I'm working on, where I have been making some pictures from the air, is at this military installation called Dugway Proving Ground in the desert in Utah. And it's a classified military site. It took me a decade to get permission to work there. And I was able to make some aerial photographs of some of these test sites where they're testing, detonating different substances in the desert on these test grids, and measuring toxicity levels over time and space. Mm. And they look a little bit like the Nazca lines, or a little bit like a Saul LeWitt drawing kind of inscribed in the desert. Mm-hmm. They're quite abstract.
Mm-hmm.
But I had one day. And it took me 10 years to get there.
Wow.
And I had a representative of Dugway in the plane with me. Every single site I was photographing that day had been vetted. Some were approved, some were not. I had an assistant with me. I had a pilot who, as it turned out, was not born in the United States, and almost at the last second we weren't going to be able to work with him because he was not,
wow,
a national, as they say. But then that, we got past that hurdle. So, you know, there it was so many constraints. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so much kind of riding on it in a way. And I had one crack at it. So that's one extreme.
Yeah.
You know, other extremes are, like, I've been working on this project at Owens Lake, in California since 2001, and I just went back there again in 2015. So, you know, it's something that I think I'll keep doing periodically for the rest of my life. But getting back to the question about funding, I want to say how essential it was for me when I was young and just starting out. I got a $5,000 grant from the National Endowment for the Arts when they were giving individual artist grants, and that enabled me to go do this extensive project on mining in the West. It was my first major collegiate work. And, you know, those grants don't exist anymore, which is really a shame.
Mm.
But $5,000 made a world of difference to me in my whole life as an artist, you know, at that, and from, you know, to be able to kind of have that opportunity to develop a project, you know, from start to finish. That's all it took.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
That's all it took. And without that grant, I wouldn't have been able to do it.
Sure. So what about the last, say, 5 years? I mean, are those, to what's the division of your own funds,
I'm always funding. I'm always funding projects myself.
Okay.
A couple of years ago, I was invited, basically commissioned, to participate in a project. It was the 500th anniversary of the death of the painter El Greco, And the city of Toledo, Spain, invited a number of different contemporary photographers to work there, to kind of, I don't know, like in a way sort of celebrate the city. So I think Vic Muniz went, and Abe Morel did work there, and there were maybe a dozen, Philip Lorca de Corsia. And I was asked to make aerial work in Toledo. So as it turned out, I had to work from a helicopter there because of their own restrictions, but it was funded. Yeah. And then while I was there, I also got to make work for myself that fell outside of the parameters of that specific commission.
Yeah.
So, but it was funded.
Nice.
So, you know, you get it where you can, right?
Sure.
You know, sometimes it works where being assisted in situations like that to make work for myself. And at other points, like with, say, this Dugway thing, it's something that I'm, you know, quite eager to make happen. So you do.
So the plane that you flew at Dugway, was that was one that you had to fund then?
Exactly. Yeah. It had to not be a military
right.
Plane. I needed to use my own pilot with his own resources. Yeah.
And so artists, you know, have to come up with the money for their own art supplies, obviously. But so how much of a risk is, for example, that project as far as an investment? You know, are you feeling vulnerable, you know, when you're putting that money out there for that rental and so on?
No, I'm not. I mean, I'm careful with how I, I'm aware that, you know, I need to do it. And, I'm trying to be careful with, whatever the budget may be, but you know, projects, it's like you just have to do it. You just have to make
sure.
It work. And I've been really fortunate that I've had, you know, good gallery representation that has gotten my work out there. And so, you know, I can anticipate that there will be sales of work.
Yeah.
To some greater or lesser degree, but there will be sales of work for sure over time of a project that I may just be getting started with. So it's an initial investment that I know I'll eventually recoup.
Right. And has that been the case over the last 10, 15 years, you know, that you've, I mean, with the market changes and whatnot, that you've have the same level of more or less confidence that that's going to pay, you're going to get paid back?
Yeah. Yeah, it doesn't, you know, I can't say what, and I don't track, okay, now I'm recouped my investment and it's taken, you
sure.
know, X months or
sure.
X years or whatever. But yes.
That's sure. nice.
I mean, I'm really, yeah, no, it's astonishing. And, you know, I'm really fortunate that I work with some galleries that really believe in my work and do a really good job of in all aspects of what it means to represent that work.
Yeah.
So
that's great.
I mean, I'm working toward a show in January here in San Francisco with Haynes Gallery, and I've been with them for something like 14 years and really respect them and enjoy working with them. And so this will be work from Dugway Proving Ground, that project I was describing. And it'll be aerial photographs. It'll be photographs on the ground. It'll be sequences of photographs on the ground. It'll be interiors of high-tech labs, so quasi-architectural photographs. And it'll actually be a 30-minute film made from something like 50,000 individual frames of aerial photographs. So kind of my first venture into making a piece that will be projected. And it's a multimedia thing that I've collaborated on with an LA sound artist and composer, Chris Kallmeyer. So it's like moving into different terrain, and it's great to feel like I have the support of this gallery. They are really excited to see, you know, the changes and developments in my work. Mm-hmm. So
when you mentioned Owens Valley earlier, and for people who mm-hmm. are listening who are not familiar, it's a part of California where there's a huge erosion dust bed problem from drought, and it's caused a lot of environmental problems. So when you're, and I imagine that you've done other photography photo projects that have involved the, you know, showing part of the environmental degradation that's going on. Is there a part of the thinking process at some point that goes through the cost of photographing, you know, from the air, in conjunction, you know, in sort of in weird relation to the, you know, degradation that's going down below? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think I see where you're going with this. So steer me.
Yeah. In other words, I'm sort of walking on eggshells, sort of trying to make the comparison of, you know, when you're using fuel to to fly.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's a little silly, but it's also something that kind of needs to be put out there.
No, it's a really critical question, and so I'll tell you, when I first started that project that I was describing that got funded by the NEA a long time ago, I came back from that trip and I hand processed all my film, my black and white film, using all this chemistry, you know, that
right.
then, and I'm working with silver, you know, the whole project was about mining, you know, and using water. So using basically all these natural resources. Yeah.
Yeah.
Printing on paper. As I was researching a project on clear cutting of the forest in Maine, where I was living at the time. And I made my contact sheets and then I ground to a halt and I wasn't really sure what to do. I really wrestled with that question and those set of issues, which is why and how do I get to do this?
Yeah.
And how, and what I had to come to was this understanding that I'm complicit. Yeah. I am so effing complicit mm-hmm. in these locations. And even at that point in my life where I owned very little and I was living with my then girlfriend, now wife, in this tiny little converted barn that we heated with a wood stove, you know, it was almost entirely off the grid. Mm-hmm. But I could not be an innocent and I couldn't be better than, I could only be part of. And it didn't, though, mean that I shouldn't have a voice to critique something or eyes with which to see it and witness it and put it out in the world. And that's what I realized was like, this is my effing job. Mm-hmm. This mm-hmm. is what I'm making my job as mm-hmm. an artist, right? I mean, I'm not like an activist per se. I'm not an environmental attorney. I'm not like a geologist or some kind of like hydrologist or an engineer or whatever, but like, I have concerns, and one way that I get to voice those concerns is through pictures. I'm a picture maker. Yeah. And so that's, I mean, and it was not this, I'm giving you the really short version.
Sure.
Because, you know, I felt like I was kind of like diving into the depths of my soul. Like, mm-hmm. what do? I'm just at a dead end. And I still feel like very conscious. I mean, I don't fly all the time. I do it in these kind of concentrated sort of episodic bursts, you know, to go out and make work. And then I spend a long time like developing the project, you know, so like post-production is part of it. Well, it all happens on computers and the computers all use, you know, aluminum and lithium and all these other elements. So like, I'm still immersed in it, you know, and I'm printing on paper using pigment inks now. And where does that stuff come from? And so there's a way, in a weird way, like the work is critiquing exactly what photography is made of. You know, it's whether it's the digital world or the pre-digital world, you're looking at minerals and things that are mined from the ground, and paper that comes from trees, and water that, you know, is a natural resource and essentially gets made toxic by the photographic chemistry. And yeah, I'm sort of cutting apart all the elements of photography. You know, that wasn't aware of it for a long time, but that's part of it.
Yeah.
But I'm, you know, I the only way I could get to that, and I don't, there's, I mean, you know, there's a lot of work out there now on environmental issues, you know, photography that considers environmental issues. And I think the problem that I have with so much of it is there seems to be an assumption that the photographer or the artist is making, or a stance that they're making, which is like, I will show you how wrong you guys are, you know? And it's kind of a lecture. And I think it's a much more kind of complex set of issues than that. And I don't think the work that I'm making kind of answers those questions. Maybe they get to ask some questions, but
yeah,
you know, I mean, you really, it's a great question. It touches a nerve in me, and you can tell, probably, because it's definitely a set of issues that I still think about. But, well, you know, the bottom line is we can't afford to be so innocent.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
We just can't.
Right. I was just going to say, if this is as, you know, as angry and or defensive as you get, I think we'll be okay. no, but I think I just want to sort of point out that I think the bottom line is for you and for a lot of us is that we do have to rationalize. You know, we are complicit. We do have to use these chemicals to greater or lesser degrees. You know, you as a photographer accessing planes and helicopters might use a little bit more, you know, but, you know, I could continue down that road, parsing the whole route from idea to sale, you know, and everything in between. But, you know, that might get a little academic or a little preachy or whatever. But, you know, I guess from my perspective, I recognize that because I've been flirting with using some chemicals myself, you know, and most artists use chemicals, as I said, to greater or lesser degrees. So, you know, it really does kind of come down to, I would rather, and I'm speaking for you too, I would rather participate and live with the guilt, you know, or whatever word you want to use of participating.
Sure.
Than to just say, you know, no, I'm going to be a breatharian, you know, or whatever.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I certainly had breatharian tendencies as a youth.
Right.
So, yeah. I mean, I wanted to be pure. I did. You know,
yeah.
I was like a macrobiotic. I was, you know, I was like, I had those kinds of like extreme positions. You know, I would more flirt with them than embrace them, but they interested me. And so it was a kind of reckoning, you know, and maybe a sort of, I don't know, like process of maturation to just admit that, like, I'm in it. I'm of it. I'm using it. I'm, you know, I want to do this for myself. And this is how I think I'm going to move forward in the world, you know, and not be above it.
Yeah.
Know?
Yeah. But do you, I mean, just as one final point, do you have you had thoughts and or conversations about, you know, reverse carbon footprints, you know, buying, investing in what have you,
yeah.
Volunteering and so on, that kind of thing?
Yeah, for sure. And I think that those are really interesting ways to engage, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's really a different world now, I think, at least the world that you and I occupy, in terms of people's comprehension of the environment. Yeah. It wasn't even a subject really then. It was sort of like, oh, the last time we talked about that was like, you know, in the 60s, like we were talking about ecology, you know, and like it was a kind of, it's really different different era. I mean, now, yeah, you can have climate deniers and climate change deniers and things like that, but we all know.
Yeah.
And we've seen it just in the past, you know, months with all of these ravaging storms. You know, we know that we're changing the planet irrefutably. We're on that path. You know, we're in the Anthropocene era. We know what that word involves, entails.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, either we're going to pay the price, or our neighbors are going to pay the price, or our children and grandchildren are going to pay the price. You know, you can't weasel your way around it. Yeah.
Perfect. So. Perfect. Circle back to your daughter. I mean, has your daughter had that conversation with you? I mean, just to sort of put out the most ridiculous kind of cliche or caricature of that conversation. But Dad, you know, what are you doing to my planet kind of thing?
No, we really haven't had that conversation. I think one of the most, I guess, meaningful experiences that we've had together was when she was, I think, 10 years old. I took her with me on a trip to Iceland.
Mm.
And we were kind of camping our way, not just around the periphery, the perimeter of the island, but also across the interior. And with another photographer friend of mine and his wife and son.
Mm-hmm.
And a guide. And the guide was key. But that experience for her, I think, has stayed really fresh and alive, and this kind of, I don't know, this moment that really, you know, had great meaning for her, because she was exposed to nature, you know, 24/7, you know, at this time of year when the sun was like barely setting. And, you know, it's much more kind of a primordial landscape. And she's, you know, hasn't been back since, although we keep talking about it. She I know, would love to go back, as would I. But that was like a formative experience for both of us together, even in our relationship. So I don't know that we've had the experience about, you know, how we're effing up the planet so much. It's we're, you know, she's a politically aware young person, mm-hmm. for sure.
Yeah. Got it.
I guess the most recent way that we actually talked about it was we were both driving diesel cars that were recalled by Volkswagen. and I, it's a her, you know, environmental photographer, you know, driving, trying to do the right thing by, you know, driving this car that he thinks is getting, you know, great mileage and is clean,
yeah.
only to find out that in fact it's spewing, you know, 40 times the amount into the air that it
wow.
legally is allowed to do. So, yeah.
And she was following your lead with the Volkswagen?
Yeah. I mean, I guided her toward it.
That's hilarious. Oh, geez. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Needless to say, neither of us are driving those cars anymore.
Good. Before we wrapped up, I definitely wanted to get to Steidl, if that's the correct pronunciation. We would be crazy to pass that over. And just to set this up for listeners a bit, we had talked about in scheduling when we were going to talk that you could potentially get called away at any moment to go to Germany to print with this revered printer who makes primarily, I guess, photographic books, one of which she's done with you. And so I wanted you to talk about the experience with working with him, and maybe you can recall any particular profound moments. And I'll just also add that there was a profile of this guy in The New Yorker, and one of the things that I recall is that he can be very severe with his charges, you know, his guests, to the point where some of them have cried based on his tone, if I recall.
I
think that's what the article said.
I don't know. I mean, I thought it was an excellent piece, and I'm not doubting that may have happened, but I really think highly of Gerhard, and he's incredibly generous. But there is a toughness there too. But I think a large part of that is the pressure that he puts on himself and the pace of work, and the intensity of work and the number of projects he has, at various stages at any given time. So when you're on site, you stay in a building next door to his press. So you're available. And actually when you're actually on press, you stay pretty much in the building. You're fed, lunch. So by, wonderfully healthy lunch by his chef, so that you don't have to leave and wander through the town, so that you're accessible, but it's also a way of making a kind of community aspect of it. So I don't think it's Gerhardt's personality that is making people cry. I don't think. Gerhardt's really, he is one of the most droll senses of humor of any human being I've ever met. Uh-huh. So, there's a kind of myth around him, but he is, I find, really charming and funny, and the process of making a book with him is super intense. You better... yes, you want to go in prepared. I think many photographers, when they're working with him, the entire book may be designed by his graphic design team. And because I have been working with a graphic designer here in the Bay Area for a long time, a guy named Bob Offaldish, and he's done a number of books of mine with me, for me, I have on both the prior book that I've done with Gerhardt and the one that's coming up soon, work with Bob. So like the attention to detail that I get to put into the book before I even get there, mm-hmm. I think relieves me of a certain amount of
right
those anxieties.
So other than having these really healthy chef prepared lunches and whatnot, are you essentially in his print shop kind of waiting for the next run and then sort of having him give you the first eye on them before he takes an eye, or what? Kind of give me a little bit of a snapshot of what the day is like.
Sure. Well, so I made two trips there to work on this book that came out in 2013, and the title is Black Maps, and it was basically seven different chapters of landscape, aerial landscape projects of mine. And so the first trip was to do pre-press, so to take all the images and to test different paper and ink combinations, mm-hmm. and to fine tune to whatever, to the greater degree as possible, to look at blue lines of the book. So, basically making sure that there's no errors in typography, mm-hmm. that were, any of the text or mm-hmm. in the layout of the book, mm-hmm. Things like that. And I will say that on that first trip, we had different essays for each chapter, so seven different essays plus something I had written. So there's a lot of text. And when I got to Stadelville, as it's called, I would say the essays were about 95% done. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't really aware that they needed to be locked down.
Right.
So my last minute scramble, and I don't think I cried, but I might have wanted to, tears of frustration, because uh-huh. I thought I was so ready, was, we had to get that last 5% done. And so you're coordinating from Germany with an editor who's in New York, who at that point, I believe his wife was in labor with their child, to the graphic designer on the West Coast, to the writers who were all around, over the place. So to get those last few bits together, under pressure, that was tough, but it all worked out. Right. The degree of exactitude that photographers and other artists who are working with Steidl can get on press, and the amount of respect and kind of latitude that, that Gerhard gives. So for example, with this next book, which will be on, it's called Proving Ground, and it's on that military installation, you know, I'll go over and do pre-press, and, you know, we'll probably experiment with a whole range of different papers and inks. So, and especially with this particular project where the work is much more abstract, I'm not really sure where it's going to land at all. So, you know, maybe I should be ready for some more cheers myself, but it'll in one way be much more freeing, because with the Black Maps book, I knew exactly what I wanted every single image to look like. Right. But here there's much greater latitude for how I think they can land. But also with that comes, you know, experimentation, and you just don't really, you just don't know. So to me, there's like actually more freedom, more questions, but more room for not failure, but just not really sort of predetermining it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
when you mention him and his fastidiousness, you know, which is sounds pretty extreme, you know, in a good way. It made me think of one of these cliches, or maybe it's not really a cliche because it's not that common, but more of a perception about photographers that they tend to be more fastidious, maybe a little more anal in some cases. And you, I'm pretty sure, don't fit into that mold. And I just wonder if you feel, if that's a notion you're familiar with, and if you are somehow one of those photographers who's sort of able to reconcile the fastidious, the anal, with the experimental, you know, and the loose.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm totally fastidious and anal. But I mean, that's like my native state, but I've done as much work as possible over the decades to unleash that and subvert it and turn it inside out. And, you know, it probably has as much to do with my embracing aerial photography and like this elements of the unknown and risk and chance. But my native state is, I mean, it's just, you know, it's like an architect, right? It's like,
yeah,
a, you know, OCD. Yeah.
Right.
But I think I'm much more, one of the great things about getting older is, I mean, at least for me, I'm a much more relaxed person now than I was when I was half my age.
How much of that is, do you think, just, you know, time and experience and, you know, and wisdom versus any sort of self-improvement that you've done?
It's the same thing. It's all the same. I mean, I don't know. I think here's the deal. I knew when I was young that I had those qualities to a degree that I found becoming potentially stultifying.
Right.
And you know, and so I knew, I mean, even the impulse to sort of volunteer, hey, Emmett, can I go with you to Mount St. Helens? You know, like to get out of my comfort zone. That's a quality that I really need. And so those kinds of moments, those, and they don't happen every day or necessarily even, you know, every month, but those kind of moments where you kind of get, you see an opportunity to slip out of your usual way of being into something else that is not predetermined and not mapped out and not clear. That's how I function, mm-hmm. you know, as an artist. And I think that's the key. That's the key for getting just, you know, out of the life of studiousness.
Yeah. So, you know, I think that self-awareness about the anal and OCD and the awareness as well to get out of your comfort zone, that's a gigantic first step. You know, that makes all the difference, you know, because a lot of anal people are, I think, a little more blinded to that element.
Yeah, yeah. No, for sure. And I think, honestly, the thing that you do gain, I don't know if I've gained wisdom, like, I don't know if that's the right word,
mm-hmm.
but I certainly gained a sense of humor about myself
right.
that you know, that I probably couldn't afford to have when I was younger. So that's a good thing, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's, I mean, one of the things that one byproduct or analog to wisdom is learning to not give as much of a fuck, you know, and that's not as easy as it sounds.
Right. Right. And or just give a fuck about the things that, that actually count.
That count.
Yeah. And so
absolutely.
you have to be more discerning about what those mean. And, you know, maybe the things you thought you should be so obsessively concerned with are, you know, you have to refine what they are. Right.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Well, David, I know there's more that we could talk about. I mean, I didn't even ask you about working with people like Jonathan Lethem for your one of your catalogs, but I think we covered the bulk of it. Do you feel that way too?
Good. I think we did a really fine job. Thank you so much.
Thank you, David. It was great talking to you.
I feel like one of these days, one of the artists that you have as a guest is going to say, "When can I interview you for your own podcast?" Is that ever going to happen?
Well, people have said, when is somebody going to interview you? People have said that before.
Right.
Nobody has actually asked that question who has their own podcast. So that's what needs to happen.
Oh, okay.
If you know anybody who hosts a podcast, feel free to recommend
me.
But I'm not holding my breath.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Not going to happen. But you're at episode more than 200, right?
You are 201, actually. Yeah.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah.
Kudos to you. That's amazing.
Yeah. Thanks. I appreciate it. And we're out. Thank you very much again to David for talking to me. I hope you guys enjoyed that. If you have any comments or questions for me about that or for him, I will be happy to pass them along. And I'm going to give you a little piece of photography-related news in just a sec. Just a couple quick things. Reminder, the website for the show is theconversationpod.com, where you can link to giving nice reviews on iTunes or Stitcher. You can follow the show on social media at Artist Podcast on Instagram and Twitter. You're welcome to suggest guests for future episodes. And otherwise, just let us know whatever comments you have. Also wanted to let you know about sponsorship opportunities. If you are interested in creating ads or other sponsorship situations for a gallery, museum, nonprofit, or otherwise, or interested in promoting a particular artist related to a show or otherwise, do get in touch with me. I will pass your information along to the podcast's agent, Sarah, and she will take it from there. So sponsorship opportunities, do find out more if you are curious. And lastly, before I get to that piece of news, I wanted to give a big thank you to Nick Ward, who has helped me put together a redo of my art website. His website is nickwardonline.com. You can reach mine via the About page of The Conversation. Should be up, hopefully, by the time you listen to this. So thanks again, Nick, for your help. All right, so wanted to just let you know this is courtesy of Weisslink, that related to photography, a figure I am not familiar with, Robert Delpire, Delpire, I'm not sure if that's the pronunciation. This is from the New York Times. Robert Delpire, early advocate of photography, dies at 91. The French curator and publisher was the director of the Centre National de la Photographie, now part of the Jeu de Paume. For more than a decade, Delpire was a key figure in advancing the understanding of photography as fine art. So I thought that relevant to this particular episode, thought I would give it to you, courtesy of Weisslink. Jeff Weiss, by the way, former guest on this podcast from a couple years ago. All right, guys, I think that does it for this week, this episode. Look forward to hearing from you. Look forward to talking to you in a couple of weeks. Until then, ciao for now.